I was given a subject in which I chose, and now I'm assigned it. And I've had a little difficulty over it, particularly my last point. So what I've done on my last point is tuck in another message on the last point. It was my privilege just about 3 weeks ago to come back from a trip overseas. And I go overseas nearly every fall to visit our overseas work. And this year the trip took us all the way around the world. And I come back optimistic, personally, that God is at work in this world and there's some wonderful things that are taking place. And I like to refer to the fact that it's like the temple in the Old Testament that went up without the sound of a hammer. And so today God's work is going on, and relatively without fanfare, without a great deal of publicity, but God is at work nevertheless. And with Cuba and Vietnam and India and the wall in Berlin and the wall in Jerusalem and the refugees that are constantly on the move around the world, God still hasn't lost control. He's still working out His purposes. I know one thing. I didn't see this on this trip myself. But you know, we heard for years how difficult it is in Spain, the gospel. When George Sanchez was there last year, George is our overseas director, he found that the Plymouth Brethren have 60 assemblies in Madrid, Spain, averaging about 100 people per assembly. And you know these folks, the PBs, really know the word. Well, now there are 6,000 people meeting every week in Madrid around the Word of God. That's something, isn't it? I hadn't heard about that before. To say nothing about many other wonderful works that are going on. And today in Madrid, you'll see gospel signs and buses. And I could just go on. And I know that sometimes we work away in our own little area and things are kind of tough. And we've got a little some difficulties that have stirred up and people aren't getting along with one another. And we run over here, try to calm this situation down and pour a little water over and cool that one off and so on. And then we get involved under all kinds of administrative problems, and we just kind of get under it. And we can get like the prophet who thought, there's nobody left with me. And God said, I've still got 7,000 of them who've not bowed the knee to Baal. And so God is at work in this world. And I think that particularly where God is at work and you see things happening and people turning to Christ is where they see the example of what a Christian life is lived out before their eyes. I know I don't know much about reaching Muslims or Mohammedans, but I have been told by those who have given their lifetime to reaching them that where they can see the Christian life exemplified, lived in vitality before them, that in those places they are turning to Christ. We all heard it said, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. And that's what we need, the demonstration, isn't it? And this is my theme for tonight, pace setting, being examples, a pattern. About a year ago, a little over, Billy Graham was here and we had a half day together. And he said, Lorne, I believe that one thing that God is doing today is this, around the world, that here is a person, and in this country is one here, and this place, and that place, and the other place. And He is preparing people of stalwart, sterling Christian character who are really living Christ, who that in the days of increasing darkness, and according to the Word, it'll get darker, but in the darkness, the light shines brighter. And here God is preparing these people, lights who will shine in this dark world all around. And you know, I was thinking, have you read any of Watchman Nee's work? Well, as you know, Watchman Nee has been languishing in prison for a number of years in Red China. And I've thought of this, of how much his writings and some of them have meant to me. Well, do you think that God has forgotten about His servant there? And I wouldn't be surprised at all that God is doing some great things among some Chinese through the life and testimony of that man, wherever he is right tonight. But you know, this is what we need to be. You and I should be examples, pace setters. But I have to confess that as for me, and I suppose for you too, that when I even mention the word being a pace setter or example, my heart kind of skips a beat. And I just feel a little flush comes over my face. I say, oh no, not me. I mean, I'm not an example to anybody about anything. Pace setter? Me? Well, let's talk about it a little bit, shall we? First of all, I think we ought to remember this, that you are a pace setter whether you like it or not. And there are people that are copying what we do, whether it's good or bad, whether we like it or not. Because people are imitators. What about your kids? The thing that we're embarrassed about that they do in public, they might have saw us do at home. I used to make this statement about, well, a certain kind of food, you know, particularly the fattened kind, I hate it. Oh, I hate it. Sort of a little joke. Until it comes along, we're out to eat, and they pass the peas around, and my child doesn't want any. Why? I hate it. Or you take a church. You show me a pastor who's strong in prayer, I'll show you a church who's strong in prayer. Pastor who's strong in prophecy, here's a church who's strong in prophecy. Show me a pastor who's strong in criticizing other Christians, and you've got a group full of church people that are strong in criticizing other Christians. People are imitators, and we're pace setters already, whether we like it or not. And people are reading us. Ye are our epistle, known and read of all men. And I was just thinking today, if you want to be read, really read, R-E-A-D, as to whether or not we're the real thing or a fake, one is to be around teenagers, and the other is to be around semi-drunks. I remember this happened to me. I've been around both. Not in my home, the teenagers in the home. But I remember some years ago, I went to England with the Graham team. Arrived there the first night, it was a typical British night, Charlie Riggs and I. Got to our room about 10:30. We're going to be gone from home about 5 or 6 months. We got to our respective rooms in the hotels, sat on the bed, blue as could be, kind of down and depressed. I called him up on the phone and said, Charlie, what are you doing? Nothing. He said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. Let's go for a walk. So we went down the Oxford Street in London, and we'd never been there, and we thought that something was going to jump out at us from every alleyway or doorway. And we looked for a place to get a cup of coffee and a bite to eat and couldn't find a thing. I didn't know they rolled up the streets in London. It was really dead. But finally we found on the second story a light there, and it looked like, the little sign indicated that was a place to get a bite to eat. So we went up there. And there are just a few people in the place, but one of them was very obviously American. You could tell, of course, by the cut of the clothes and the tie and all the rest, and more so than these days. There isn't so much difference in clothes, I noticed, this fall, but there was then. But this American was partly drunk. And he recognized this American. Hello there! Boy, we were kind of embarrassed. This loud American, all these British around here. Ooh, be quiet. And so he came over and sat down by Charlie and me. Wanted to know where we were from and all the rest and what we were doing. And I was just kind of uncomfortable. And Charlie told him how we were there with the Billy Graham team and all. Oh, he says, Billy Graham? He looked at me and he said, you won't make a good missionary. I said, I won't. Why not? And he went like this. But you know, he hit the nail right on the head. Yes, sir. He read me like a book. My inner attitude just showed all over the place. That's what I mean. You can be read by a semi-drunk. But people are reading us, whether they're semi-drunk or teenagers or not. And so we are leaving an impression. The question is, what kind of impression? What kind of impression? So what kind are you? What kind am I? Titus 2:7, it says, in all things showing thyself a pattern of good works. showing thyself a pattern of good works. Do you, ladies, do any sewing? You go down and you sort through the patterns, or maybe you buy the material first, or one way or the other, and you pick out this pattern, you figure that when you come home and lay it down on the material, cut it out and sew it up, that that pattern is something worth copying. That's what a pattern is. Something that's worth copying. And so we're to be something that's worth copying. Not necessarily just worth listening to, but worth copying. I thought, well, you know, would I like to be known as a great Bible teacher? I thought, no, I'd rather be known as a Bible doer. Something worth copying. More than just worth listening to. But someone who's worth copying, I'm certain will be worth listening to. Don't you think so? In 1 Timothy 4:12, Paul said to Timothy, "Let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers. Word, conversation, charity, spirit, faith, purity." When I first had my first navigator assignment, which was 19 years ago, up in Seattle, Washington. And I had been working away there as just a kid. I don't know. We were really short of manpower in those days. That's how come I had a responsibility so early. It was early. Really, it was. But I remember the vice president of the work came at that time. Harold Christman came up to see me. And he spent about 2 or 3 days. And he had a couple words of admonition to me. And one of them was this. He said, "Lorne, I couldn't say anything more to you than this one thing, that above all else, as a young man, that you would be an example of the believers." You think of older people as being an example of the believers, but Paul said to Timothy, you be an example of what a believer ought to be. Now this is an ideal that's held up before us, isn't it? Now, you may be a good administrator, we may be politicians, we may be good socially, we may not be. But whatever else we are, we ought to be examples of the believers. Now, I don't know about you, but I realize that this convicts me. And the moment I think about it, I realize that there are things that are occupying my attention, or at least that are clamoring for my attention, that really are not top priority. That are really not as important as this is. Now we ought to be the kind of an example, have the kind of a life, be the kind of a pattern that brings honor and glory to God. What about Matthew 5:16? "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." Now we have a couple of things in that verse. One is that we should let our light so shine that they might see our good works, but glorify who? Our Father which is in heaven. And that's very important because that's the motive. Because if the motive is just sort of kind of humbly but modestly walk around and say, "Well, just look at me." Well, we're going to fall flat on our face before long. Not only do you fall flat on your face, but sooner or later you'll blow apart emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. We've got to have our objectives right, isn't it? It's that He might be glorified. I remember some years ago, I was reflecting on that verse. Well, how does my showing forth good works glorify God? And I thought of a boy who might be in junior high school then. And you're walking by the school one day and you're watching him play a ball game. And somebody throws him the ball and hits him right on the end of the finger. Maybe the thing goes out of joint. But he doesn't set up a big fuss about it. It hurts, tell it, has to drop out of the game. But there's just a poise and a bearing about this fella. And later up you walk alongside of him, you get a chance to mention this to him. He said, "Well, my dad is teaching me that a fella just got to take it. Something like this happening, he can't go to pieces. So my dad tells me." Well, then you begin to observe this fellow. And around school, for it, you notice that he gets his work done. Nothing show off about him, he just gets it done. And you ask him about it. "Well, my dad told me that He teaches me the fellow ought to get the most out of school and get his work done. Then you notice something else about him, that he's courteous, rather unusual trait. He actually takes time to open the door for a lady. Nothing show-off again, it's just sort of part of him. And you're asking about this, you said, well, my dad teaches me. Well, after this goes on for a while, you'd kind of like to meet that boy's dad, wouldn't you? So by his action and what he has to say about it, the way he goes about it brings honor, if you want to call it this, dignity, or to use the word, glorifies his dad. Now in our action, by what we do, by how we react, by what we say, by our example, we bring glory, dignity, honor. We reflect upon our Heavenly Father. And the thing of it is, we should reflect favorably upon Him. What do we do when somebody comes up in the church and they're trying to split things up or we're misrepresented? What is our reaction? Not only in our church, but in our family with the kids. Here a child reacts to us. Well, that isn't so bad. How do I react to his reaction? These are the things that begin to show, aren't they? It's in these areas I need to be a pace setter. Now, if I had to sort of summarize, well, what do we mean then by a pace setter? Three things. And they're sort of progressive. First of all, we've mentioned this, a pace setter is a pattern or an example. Not a competitor. The purpose of being a pace setter is not to compete with somebody else. Now, of course, the idea of pace setting comes from the idea of a runner. Here you've got a track meet, and these fellows are running the mile. You have one man whose job is to set a pace for the other man so that the other runner can run to his maximum. Not beyond his maximum, then he'd fold up before the mile was over. But to get out of him the maximum, a pace setter. But it's not to compete against him. Now, our purpose then in being a pace setter for other Christians is not to compete against them. And here is a subtle little thing, I believe, the difference between real pace setting and pride. Because what is pride? Pride is essentially competition, is it not? A person isn't proud because they feel they're good looking. They're proud because they feel they're better looking than someone else. They're not proud because they feel they have money. It's because they have more money. They feel they have more money than somebody else. They're not proud because they have a nice home. It's because they feel they have a nicer home than someone else. So when pace setting, or this idea of an example comes, so I set myself over and against somebody else, that's competition. That isn't real pace setting. That's not the scriptural idea of example or pattern. It's an example. Now, for instance, yeah, this is kind of a poor one, but this is a Windsor knot. Is that a Windsor knot right there in your tie? It's a facsimile. It looks pretty good. Is that a Windsor right there? You think it's a fake? Well, that's a good, honest answer. What have you got there, Frank? Is that a Windsor? Good. You know that's a Windsor, don't you? Okay, well, tell us how to tie a Windsor knot in a tie, will you? You have. I know you have. Now, I must have done it, too. How many of you men know how to tie a Windsor knot in a tie? Okay. Cypher, you tell us. How do you tie a Windsor knot in a tie? No. You're not doing too well yet. You sure are. But you'd be a long time telling a person how to tie a Windsor knot in a tie or how to tie a shoestring. But Rod Sargent taught me how to tie a Windsor knot years ago. And the way we did it was he put the tie around my neck and he had me make the motions. And by showing me here, well, I learned how in just a couple times. So if we want to get a personal witness, what's the way we, how do we do it? Tell them how to do it or show them how to do it? If we want to have a person in our church learn how to have a quiet time, what do we do? Tell them how or show them how? Well, we have to show them how. And so that's my next point. A person is a pattern. He can do it himself. He's an example. But a pace-setter is a way-shower as well. He shows the other person how he too can do the same thing. Here we have 1 Corinthians 4:15-17. For though ye have 10,000 instructors in Christ, yet have ye not many fathers. For in Christ Jesus I have begotten you in the gospel. Wherefore I beseech you, be ye followers of me. For this cause have I sent unto you Timothy, who is my beloved son and faithful in the Lord, who shall bring you into remembrance of my ways which be in Christ, as I teach everywhere in every church. Now this idea of being a pace setter or an example is not a perpendicular thing of where I say to somebody, now listen to me, this is the way it ought to be done. Rather, it's on the horizontal. It simply means that I have gone down the road of Christian experience a little farther than someone else, and then I simply sort of go back and take them by the hand and help them around the curves and the chuck holes in the road and show them a way shower. It's leading, not lording over them. It's showing them how. Now, Doss Trotman adopted me as his spiritual son when I was about a year old in the Lord. And I heard him speak many times on the importance of a quiet time and of meeting the Lord in the morning. But you know, as I look back now on my life with Doss, I can't remember. Those sermons and those messages just fade away. I don't think I can call any specific one. At this moment, I can't even call any specific place where I heard him, though I'm sure it was dozens of times. But do you know what I remember? I remember when I was just a kid, 19, had charge of a conference in Mount Hermon, California. And Doss was one of the speakers. And I didn't know beans about running a conference. I'd never been to one in my life, and they put me in charge of this one. But the pastors in our denomination, I got them to okay Doss as a speaker, so he was there. And he began to help me in such things as how to make announcements and all this kind of thing. I didn't know anything about it. About the second day of the conference, he said, Lorne, how would you like to get together for a little time of prayer tomorrow morning? Boy, I said, great. I said, what time? He said, 5 o'clock. Pardon me? 5 o'clock. I said, okay, where? He said, well, down by the stream, down by the little stream there at Mount Hermon, behind the cabin, there's a little beach in the sand. And I got down there the next morning at 5 o'clock. He already had a little fire going. How long he'd been there, I don't know. And we had an hour and a half or so of prayer together in the Word. He said, how about tomorrow morning? And the next morning we did the same thing. Well, I'm going to tell you, that has indelibly stayed upon my mind. He showed me, did it with me. And there's a sermon that has lasted, and I'll never forget. And I think a lot of times we get up to our people and we say, do this and do this, and challenge them to the other thing and challenge them to do this. Or maybe just one showing could be worth many, many sermons. In fact, I think that sometimes the general idea is extant that the way to build bigger and better churches is to build bigger and better sermons. And I haven't ever tried to build a church, but I've preached a lot of messages. And if that's the way to do it, I'm kind of discouraged as to any possibility that this old boy is going to amount to much. A way shower. Not only that, but a pace setter is a stimulator. He's a pattern and example. He does it himself. He's a way shower to the next person. And then he is a stimulator to that person to get them to do it. I think that nearly all of us need someone to help us do our best. And a great blessing from God is a person that God would have around us to stimulate us, to help us do our best. If I can refer to Doss Trotman again, this is something about Doss. It used to irritate me at times. I used to feel that I did 9 things right and he'd get after me for the 10th one that I didn't do just quite right. But as I look back on it, that's what I needed. Somebody to make me do my best. I was reading about Miss Henrietta Mears, who I suppose knows as much about developing young men for the ministry as anybody I know in the country. And this was part of her procedure. Dr. Dave Cowie, Bob Munger, and others that I could name came out from under her ministry. But she was always pushing them out a little bit more. When they were accomplished this much, she'd push them to more. A stimulator. But I think a lot of us, we're content with too little. We don't expect enough. Well, now, how do I become a pace setter? I think the first thing I have to realize is that I must be a pace setter. It's important. It's paramount in importance. It's imperative. And then the second thing I got to realize is that I can't be a pace setter. So I may as well just quit pretending. I may as well quit pretending to be what I'm not really. And admit that I'm a failure and admit my failures. And then be sure that I'm starting on the solid rock of Jesus Christ Himself, and then slowly building up, little by little, foundation stone by foundation stone. I'll confess to you tonight that I'm sure of less things than I was sure of 15 years ago in my Christian life. And I might throw somebody to say, I'm sure of less things doctrinally than I was. There are some things I had some pretty pat certain answers for that I'm not really certain about right now. But I know this. There are some other things that are rock-ribbed deeper in my life than I ever have been before. And as I reflect on it, I'd rather have a few things that I am certain of and that are solid and that control my life, than a lot of things that I may be half certain of or not really thought through or that don't really guide my life. And I've had a few rude awakenings in my ministry. For instance, I grew up to think, and I was taught, that Southern Baptists were apostate. Yeah, that's the way my little denomination thought. And some of the most wonderful soul-winning preachers I ever met are Southern Baptists. I also thought that anybody that wore his collar on backwards, certainly, was, if he was born again, it was only by the skin of his teeth. Or by the skin of his collar button. And here I find I grew up in my denomination in England, they all wear their collars on backwards. And it's the strange, there's a little dinky little things. What we grow up with. That didn't really directly relate to this message, you know that. Then the next thing I'd suggest is that you get alone and make out a priority list for your life. I just can't emphasize this too often, and I'll dare say that every time you come back to the Glen, if I'm speaking, that somewhere along the line, I'll get back to the importance of doing this. I believe that every person in the Lord's work should spend at least some time, once a month, no less, reevaluating the priority list for his life. I don't see how you can carry on, how you can arrange a week schedule. I don't see how you can know where you're going to put your strokes, put your energy, unless you do that. Somebody says, well, why once a month? Because circumstances don't hold still. Life doesn't hold still. You change. Your family needs change. Your church changes. You've got problems today you didn't have a month ago. You've got opportunities now you didn't have a month ago. Life is ever dynamic, ever changing, and many of us are trying to live today's life on the way it was last year or 5 years ago. And there's another thing. No wonder we don't grow with the ministry. No wonder we don't get on top of it. Maybe we think somehow or other it's that we're going to wake up in the morning and we've got the answer clear. I think that we ought to spend a half a day or a day a month saying, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? It isn't, Lord, what will my church have me to do? What will my friends have me to do? Because you know the people that will kill you off, that are getting you tired? They're not the people that don't have anything to do with you. It's your friends that do that, isn't that right? They're the ones that are ringing the phone off the wall. They're the ones that are wearing out the doorbell. They're the ones that are wearing you out. Maybe you've heard me refer to this. It's so interesting how the Lord said to Paul, delivering thee from the people to whom now I send thee. Now, isn't that a kick? I'm going to deliver you from the very people to whom I send you. And I think this would be a pastor's prayer sometimes. Lord, deliver me from my friends. Isn't it? And you can't guide your life by what other people think you ought to do. Boy, I gave that up. Yes, sirree. There'd be a new general director of the Navigators tonight. I would be off in some padded cell somewhere. Why, if I wish that I had written down in a book the advice given me as to what I ought to do in these last 6 years. It would read like the dictionary because every other sentence would be a different subject. We'd be going off all different directions. And one of my favorite prayers is just this, what Paul prayed, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? You wives, you know that it's unfair. I know it's unfair. I believe it's unfair, the demands placed on a preacher's wife. Some occasion, this felt like, well, preacher's wife, she's supposed to be like this, supposed to do that. Why isn't she doing this? Why isn't she doing the other thing? The pressures are there. Well, I don't know any other recourse but then to get some time alone and husband. It wouldn't hurt if you take care of the kids for a half day. Let Ma get off somewhere in a car or someplace. And then say, now, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? What are my gifts that you've given me? What are the responsibilities that I have? And get that priority list. And then you pay set in that. I sure think it'll help a lot. And then when you get through there, you'll just have to let the chips fall where they may from there. We're not going to be irritable about it, but that's it. But what do we do? Here I am, I've got a list of things to do, and I've got some really important things, and they're going to take some time and some effort, but here's this little dinky thing over here that's gnawing at me. Here's this little thing over here and this little thing over there. So I'm constantly doing this little thing here and that little thing there and that little thing there, and these things I hope someday to get at. And this is one of the main reasons of getting away for a few hours like this in a stimulating fellowship to help us reevaluate our priorities. Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Now, I like to think of it in these terms. Now, Lord, what do you want me to do in my personal walk with you? That's number one. And I have my own relationship to the Lord personally. If that isn't right, then my family life isn't going to be right. I won't be good as a husband or as a father. And certainly not as a minister. That has to be first. So I have to say, well now, Lord, what do you want me to do by way of the things that, well, my relationship with you? Well, what about my quiet time? What about my Bible study? What about the basic things that I need? So ask him about that. Then the second thing is my family. Now, what responsibility do I have to my family? What responsibility do I have to my wife? What responsibility do I have to my children? And this varies. This is why you have to think about it periodically. Because children, as you know, go through stages. And it may be in a certain stage that need a little more dad's attention right now. Or maybe there are certain things in your life. I find that for me, and don't you find this, that life is not the same well laid out schedule day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year. No, we have to adapt to ever-changing circumstances, but keeping in mind the basic fundamental principles, don't we? And one advantage of having a priority list is there's nowhere to stop, or rather, where to start after your schedule gets knocked galley west. You know how that happens. But at least where to get back on the track again. And then after time goes on for a while, we figure out how to include in our schedule the galley west ideas also. You know, I think a lot of us kind of go down like life like this, always meeting emergencies, see? Oh, this emergency here, this emergency here. Maybe we could think big enough to make the emergencies the normal. Maybe they are. There's the value, again, of just getting off and thinking about it. What about my ministry? Now, what do I feel is important in the ministry that I have? What is paramount importance? Is it that I be seen at every function? Okay, then I better make arrangements to be at every function. What's important? Is it important that I have a real, fresh message from God, from the Word, every time I get up to speak? Well, then I better work on that. Well, I say, I can't get it fresh. I haven't got time for that. Well, then maybe I ought to get somebody else to help me. Maybe I don't have to preach every time the church door opens. You know, it could be that there's some layman that with a little help could help relieve that burden. It always seemed kind of strange to me that a pastor goes on vacation that there's nobody in the church that can bring even one message while he's gone. That seems real strange. And when a man's been in the church for years, you've always got to bring in somebody from the outside. That's not my notes either. I could get into that. Do you know that, Jim? Then from my ministry, my personal life, family life, the ministry that God's given me, and then just the general public and all that's involved and my general responsibility to the community at large and so on, and where I ought to fit into that. That's my first message. Now the second one we'll leave for another time. Let's pause for prayer, shall we?